6. Suffering. Visit in Virginia. In the fall of 1982, there came an invitation from Charles Haynes, who was then director of religious life at Randolph-Macon College near Richmond, Virginia, to represent Hinduism at a symposium called Perspectives on Suffering, an Interfaith Inquiry, which would take place the following spring at the college. It was a challenge for which I felt I would have to prepare well. What follows is the fruit of that. 5 world faiths would be on the platform in a 3-day format of presentations and responses, followed by audience questions. Very well planned, I thought, intelligently arranged. It should prove pleasing to a college community. As usual in such affairs, the organizers had several sponsors besides the Department of Religion of the college. Each was to present the view of his or her faith, whether scriptural, theological, historical, or whatever, on the matter of suffering. It began, however, with a disappointment for me. I had looked forward to meeting the outstanding scholar of Islam, Syed Hossein Nasser. At almost the last hour, he had called in ill and was sending a substitute. Chosen to represent Christianity was Dr. Dorothy Solle, European theologian and activist. Rabbi Harold Kushner, the author of Why Bad Things Happen to Good People, and other books, who was the Jewish spokesman. For Islam, Dr. Aziz Said, professor of international relations at American University, Washington, D.C., and Japanese Zen Buddhist professor Tokiwa. The convener, Charles Haynes, a remarkable organizer, has now become nationally known for his advocacy of comparative religious studies in private schools. We begin with the first paper on Hinduism given at the symposium. Symposium on Suffering, an Interfaith Inquiry, Randolph-Macon College, February 1983. Hinduism. Introduction. Teacher and writer Gerald Hurd, with years of study and meditation behind him on the mystics of various religions, said to a group of us, "It seems you must either take pains or bear pains. Which way will you have it?" "To be weak is miserable," cries Milton in Paradise Lost, "doing or suffering." I think the message of this entire paper may come down to just that. Mahatma Gandhi called his life work "My Experiment with Truth." I should like to borrow the phrase to refer back to another experiment with truth in the same land, some 25 centuries earlier, made by Gautama, who became the Buddha. He called his conclusion the Four Noble Truths. Suffering is a fact. Suffering has a cause. It also has a cure. And there is a way, a path, that affects the cure. It has taken a long time for the West to realize that this realism of the Buddha is not pessimism. It is widely assumed that this formulation was original with him. Probably not. It is possible that the same formulation, made with respect to bodily disease, by an ancient physician, Sushruta, in his surviving medical works, was well known at the time of the birth of Gautama. We cannot now say which came first, nor does it much matter. Suffering is our lot, stretching as far back as we can see, and also as far ahead, and every religious faith has its attitudes concerning suffering and ways to deal with it. Alas, to stand in the presence of real suffering and talk of its analysis sounds all too glib, an affront to the sufferer. Therefore, one of the first things we shall have to do in presenting various Hindu perspectives is to try to dispel the notion prevalent in the West that to be non-attached, asakta, udasina, means to be indifferent, and that a person of spiritual detachment does not feel or is not connected with the world's misery. Finally, Buddha himself gives the lie to that supposition. This world has known no greater heart than his, as his 60 years' service to man richly testifies. Isn't it the mind and heart which is set apart from self-interest that can cleanly bear the burdens and absorb the sorrows of an afflicted world? I recall being fearful when first entering the monastic life, that the end of this road might be a soul aloof, self-satisfied, no longer feeling or caring what the world feels. In short, perhaps a misanthrope. Foolish doubt. At a public class, one of our senior swamis was questioned on this very point. He said, "The illumined souls not only feel for and empathize with us in our grief, they feel it many more times, more intensely than we do. But they know how to handle it." End of quote. They are not, then, without emotion. They are in some way above emotion. On the other hand, a mother who came to visit Sri Ramakrishna just after losing her first baby son describes the meeting thus. Being told of the situation, Ramakrishna broke into sobs, which literally left pools of water on the floor beneath the cot on which he was sitting. The mother was dumbfounded, but she came away uplifted. A common element. In what is to follow, we shall examine the several historical and current viewpoints on human suffering, commencing with that of yoga philosophy and concluding with views of the Ramakrishna Vivekananda movement. I think I can predict that you will discern a common element in them all, an element which will perhaps be found in all the papers presented, namely this: that we are to shift the center and focus of our life from the ego to the non-ego, in whatever various terms the two concepts may be expressed. Jesus and Buddha were worshipped, after all, not for their explanations of suffering, but for their power to encompass it. The yoga perspective. The very definition of the word yoga is the termination of suffering. Therefore, the practicer of yoga goes through a process, which is the therapy for our suffering. Probably the earliest summation of this perspective is found in a verse of the Katha Upanishad. Smaller than the smallest and larger than the largest, the self dwells in the heart of every creature. The desireless, free from all sorrow, see its glory through the purity of their mind and senses. When desires are overcome and our mind and senses are purified, says the yogi, that inner being is seen in all its glory, This formula is impersonal, non-theistic. It contains no external deity and the grace thereof, no historical savior. Yoga makes the assumption that mind and body are real. As material substances, they will exist in some form. But when the Purusha, the real self, has disentangled itself, as it were, all of Prakriti, nature, will disappear for it, and it will shine in its own majesty. If heart is the devotee's instrument and intellect the philosopher's, the will and vital energy, or prana, are what the yogi uses. At present, our vitality is low and uncontrolled. It has to be raised by the appropriate disciplines to the level of our conscious intent. Every nerve, every muscle, virtually, can be brought under control. It is a philosophy not of agreement with nature, but of resisting and mastering nature. As Swami Vivekananda tells us, this whole body will have to be rearranged, as it were. New channels for thought will have to be made in the brain. Nerves which have not acted in your whole life will begin to work, and so on. End of quote. The capacity to concentrate, to make a laser, so to speak, of the light which is consciousness, is the destiny and innate glory of the human being. Seer and seen. What is it that we suffer from, according to Patanjali? Quote, the pain-bearing obstructions are ignorance, egoism, attachment, aversion, and clinging to life. Clear enough. We are familiar with these and their consequences. And ignorance is the root of all the others, he tells us, a concept found throughout the whole of Indian philosophy. They, the obstructions, bear fruit as pleasure and pain caused by virtue or vice. And of course, here is the law of karma, by which the wheel of samsara, our life in the world, is turned. If we experience pleasure, it is because of past virtuous action. If pain, because of past vicious or mistaken action. If all this does not appear to be true, if the wicked seem to thrive or the saintly seem to suffer, we are to understand, says Yoga, that the deeds in question will bear their fruit in the future, perhaps in our very next life. Quote, the cause of that which is to be avoided is the junction of the seer and the seen. End of quote. Now, who is the seer? The Purusha, the self of man, pure consciousness. And what is the seen? Everything else. Our suffering results from the conjunction of these two. The erroneous identification with nature, the self taking its reflection in mind and matter to be itself. Patanjali's classical eight-runged Raja Yoga is offered as the ladder for raising our consciousness to Kaivalya, a spiritual independence. Frankly, for most of us, it is too steep a climb. However, as it appeals to certain temperaments and scientific heroic personalities do aspire to it, let us see what the teaching is in an approach to the problem of suffering. The first two steps are the don'ts and the do's of moral character, without some degree of which spiritual aspiration itself does not arise, and without proficiency in which it cannot be fulfilled. The second two rungs of this ladder are body-centered disciplines of diet, posture, and breathing, which also affect the mind. Their purpose is to cleanse, lighten, and strengthen our psychophysical equipment. Without sound health and strong nerves, says the yogi, it will be difficult to achieve the transformation of consciousness required. Adaptability is the crux of yoga, and so we would want to be sure that our nerves are strong and finely tuned to bear the strain of concentration. The next stages, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi, all are degrees of mental concentration and absorption, commencing with the pulling back of the mind from sense objects and culminating in the total separation of purusha from prakriti, consciousness from nature. In any case, the mind is to be kept high. Plain living and high thinking is for the yogi. The yogi will be particularly fond of those passages in the Gita which discriminate between purusha and prakriti, and will dwell upon them to make their content a matter of direct perception, to see the play of prakriti, nature, everywhere. All is prana, only vibrating at different rates. The yogi's task is to raise up all the vibrations which come his way. Just as unholy company is to be avoided, so are low, mean thoughts. It is a fact often obscured in our skeptical, materialistic culture that one of the best ways to transcend suffering, to avoid injury and disease, and to face death in stride, is to live a clean life. Concern for the suffering of others. Admittedly, the suffering of others has not been the primary concern of the yoga approach. This does not mean that the perfected yogi is an unfeeling, uncaring person, as noted in our introduction. If we ask the Raja Yogi how to relieve the miseries of the people of the world, the reply might be that non-injury is found in yama, the prohibitions, in the very first step of yoga. The yogi too, by demonstrating the attainment of independence, does set the best possible example to suffering humanity, and may also be persuaded to instruct others in the art of yoga. Further, the community as a whole is subtly purified and uplifted by the mere presence of such souls in the society. India has many accounts of instances where this principle is evidenced. One of my teachers, for example, told of a town in India where there lived a recognized holy man, devoting all his prayer and meditation to the welfare of the community. After a few years, there was a measurable difference in the level of crime in that town. At this point, I would like to interrupt the presentation to relate some event that happened at the conference and is of great interest at this point. Rabbi Kushner and I became friends and conversed between the sessions. There was a memorable dinner over which he and I took the topic of suffering down to a more personal level. He had, as his book explains, lost his teenage son to a rare disease. It had so deeply affected him that he felt he must solve this problem of undeserved suffering, as he called it. The rabbi was unable to accept the possibility of the doctrine of karma and reincarnation to solve his riddle. The Vedantic idea that there was no undeserved suffering he found intolerable. In the end, I suggested that he had to acknowledge compensation in some form. Here he was, experiencing fame and fortune from his book and his lectures, all as a result of the tragedy. I would give every scrap of that up just to have my boy back, was his rejoinder. And who would not? Kushner gave his own account of this exchange in his second book, called When All You've Ever Wanted Isn't Enough. The perspective of devotion. Many will feel, no doubt, that in the perspective of devotion, we have a more positive approach to suffering than that of yoga. For here, suffering is eclipsed by our preoccupation with the divine being. For the Christian, love of Christ and Christ's love for us can, of course, take the sting out of pain. A man once asked Sri Ramakrishna for his opinion about the yogic disciplines of austerity, self-restraint, and all that, and drew the following reply. Yes, said the master, all those things are prescribed in the scriptures and by the teachers of spiritual tradition. But if one cultivates the love of God, the mind and senses will come under perfect control. These words epitomize divine love via the path of bhakti. This is the perspective on suffering already familiar to spiritually minded persons in the West, and it will not be necessary for us to do much more than to summarize it as found in the Indian tradition. To Hindus, the forms of God are theophanies, discovered by them and resorted to as objects of devotion and as saviors from sorrow, death, and judgment. Some are heavenly, not born on earth. For example, Shiva, Durga, Surya, Murga. While others are incarnations of Vishnu, the all-pervading Supreme Being. In this summary of devotion, we have selected the person, legend, devotees, and scriptures of the most popular of these, Sri Krishna, as representative. In the Mundaka Upanishad, soul and God are likened to two birds, inseparable companions, perched in the same tree. The tree is the body. The lower bird, the soul, hopping slowly upward through its pursuit of the sweet or sour fruits thereof, until one day it looks up at the higher bird sitting majestically at the top, merely observing it all. The soul then knows that it is not alone. The next verse tells us that one day even identity with God will be its condition. Surrendering to God, it is important for understanding Hindu bhakti or devotion to notice that God and the soul are the same species and dwell together inseparably in this human body. How, then, is the individual to ascend the tree and close the distance between himself and the Lord? First, by fulfilling the duties of life which lie close at hand, but guided by a new attitude. Surrender all action to me, Sri Krishna tells the warrior Arjuna. And fixing the mind on the self, true self, devoid of egoistic hope and free from the fever of grief, fight the battle. This formula will prevent our labor from creating further bondage. Such surrender is the mental and emotional counterpart of external sacrifice, yajna. expressed in ways both crude and sophisticated. As beginners, we quite humanly expect reward. Our devotion is motivated, sakama. The miseries we seek to be spared of are the commonest sort, penury and death. Even so, it is only the gracious Lord who hears and grants our petitions. When our worship, philanthropy, and performance of duty are all offered to God, we become free from the bonds of both evil and good results, and our hearts are united to Him in the bond of love. Those who love Him, He assures us, will never perish. Sri Krishna demonstrates this often in both phases of His earthly life, the pastoral and the civic. Quickly I come to those who offer me every action, worship me only, their dearest delight. With devotion undaunted, because they love me, these are my bondsmen, and I shall save them from mortal sorrow and all the waves of life's deadly ocean. That is from the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 12. But the signal fact of all devotional perspective is this strand of Hinduism, as in Christian devotion. It is the conviction that God is no intangible, invisible abstraction, abiding only in a heaven. He has, through His amazing grace and infinite mercy, condescended to be born on earth as a human being. In the Indian format, Lord Vishnu, taking embodiment as the darling of the cowherd village, Gokula, later to be a brilliant philosopher and statesman, appeared among us to magnetize our lives, deflect our history, and teach us what we are and what we can be. Some of these teachings are detailed in the long and comprehensive conversations with Uddhava, Sri Krishna's Brahmin disciple. "Keep my commandments," he tells him. "Practice the virtues, peace and same-sidedness, modesty, purity, and patience." The Lord concludes His message to mankind, we may say. In the summary, He discloses to Arjuna at the close of His majestic and inspiring sermon, "If conceit dwells in our heart, we are lost. But bowed and united with Him, we will, by His grace, conquer all obstacles. For the Lord dwells in the heart of every being, turning them round on the wheel of Maya. Returning to Him behind the wheel, we receive, through His grace, the state of supreme peace beyond all change. Give me your whole heart, love and adore me. Bow to me only, and you shall find me. This is my promise, who love you dearly. Lay down all duties in me, your refuge. Fear no longer, for I will save you from sin and from bondage." 18th chapter of the Gita.